Excuse us for being in your house, but we had to escape from the men who were coming. I'm sorry if we startled you. I'm Lyra, and this is Will. And these are our friends, the Chevalier Tialis and the Lady Salmakia. Could you tell us your name and where we are?
This normal-sounding request seemed to bring the man to his senses, and a shudder passed over him, as if he were waking from a dream.
I'm dead. I'm lying out there dead. I know I am. You ain't dead. What's happening? God help me. They cut my throat. What's happening?
Lyra stepped closer to Will when the man said, I'm dead, and Pantalaimon fled to her breast as a mouse. As for the Gallivespians, they were trying to control their dragonflies, because the great insects seemed to have an aversion for the man, and darted here and there in the kitchen, looking for a way out. But the man didn't notice them. He was still trying to understand what had happened.
Are you a ghost?
The man reached out his hand, and Will tried to take it, but his fingers closed on the air. A tingle of cold was all he felt. When he saw it happen, the man looked at his own hand, appalled. The numbness was beginning to wear off, and he could feel the pity of his state.
Truly, I am dead. I'm dead, and I'm going to hell.
Hush, we'll go together. What's your name?
Dirk Jensen, I was. But already I don't know what to do. Don't know where to go.
Will opened the door. The barnyard looked the same, the kitchen garden was unchanged, the same hazy sun shone down. And there was the man's body, untouched. A little groan broke from Dirk Jansen's throat, as if there were no denying it any more. The dragonflies darted out of the door and skimmed over the ground and then shot up high, faster than birds. The man was looking around helplessly, raising his hands, lowering them again, uttering little cries.
I can't stay here. Can't stay. But this ain't the farm I knew. This is wrong. I got to go.
Oh, where are you going, Mr. Jensen?
Down the road. Don't know. Got to go. Can't stay here.
Salmakia flew down to perch on Lyra's hand. The dragonfly's little claws pricked as the lady said,
There are people walking from the village. People like this man, all walking in the same direction.
Then we'll go with them,
said Will, and swung his rucksack over his shoulder. Dirk Jansen was already passing his own body, averting his eyes. He looked almost as if he were drunk, stopping, moving on, wandering to left and right, stumbling over little ruts and stones on the path his living feet had known so well. Lyra came after Will, and Pantalaimon became a kestrel and flew up as high as he could, making Lyra gasp.
They're right,
he said when he came down.
There's lines of people all coming from the village. Dead people.
And soon they saw them too, 20 or so men, women and children, all moving as Dirk Jansen had done, uncertain and shocked. The village was half a mile away, and the people were coming towards them, close together in the middle of the road. When Dirk Jansen saw the other ghosts, he broke into a stumbling run, and they held out their hands to greet him.
Even if they don't know where they're going, they're all going there together. We better just go with them.
Do you think they had demons in this world?
Can't tell. If you saw one of them in your world, would you know he was a ghost?
It's hard to say. They don't look normal exactly. There was a man I used to see in my town, and he used to walk about outside the shops always holding the same old plastic bag. And he never spoke to anyone or went inside, and no one ever looked at him. I used to pretend he was a ghost. They look a bit like him. Maybe my world's full of ghosts, and I never knew.
I don't think mine is.
Anyway, this must be the world of the dead. These people have just been killed. Those soldiers must have done it. And here they are. And it's just like the world they were alive in. I thought it'd be a lot different.
Will, it's fading. Look.
She was clutching his arm. He stopped and looked around, and she was right. Not long before he had found the window in Oxford and stepped through into the other world of Chitagatse, there had been an eclipse of the sun. And like millions of others, Will had stood outside at midday and watched as the bright daylight faded and dimmed until a sort of eerie twilight covered the houses, the trees, the park. Everything was just as clear as in full daylight, but there was less light to see it by, as if all the strength were draining out of a dying sun. What was happening now was like that, but odder, because the edges of things were losing their definition as well and becoming blurred.
It's not like going blind, even. Because it's not that we can't see things. It's like the things themselves are fading.
The colour was slowly seeping out of the world. A dim green-grey for the bright green of the trees and the grass. A dim sand-grey for the vivid yellow of a field of corn. A dim blood-grey for the red bricks of a neat farmhouse. The people themselves, closer now, had begun to notice, too, and were pointing and holding one another's arms for reassurance. The only bright things in the whole landscape were the brilliant red and yellow and electric blue of the dragonflies, and their little riders, and Will and Lyra, and Pantalaimon, who was hovering kestrel-shaped close above. They were close to the first of the people now, and it was clear they were all ghosts. Will and Lyra took a step towards each other, but there was nothing to fear, for the ghosts were far more afraid of them and were hanging back, unwilling to approach. Will called out,
"Don't be afraid. We're not going to hurt you. Where are you going?"
They looked at the oldest man among them, as if he were their guide.
"We're going where all the others go. Seems as if I know, but I can't remember learning it. Seems as if it's along the road. We'll know it when we get there."
"Mama,"
said a child,
"why is it getting dark in the daytime?"
"Hush, dear, don't fret,"
the mother said.
"Can't make anything better by fretting. We're dead, I expect."
"But where are we going? I don't want to be dead, Mama."
"We're going to see Grandpa."
But the child wouldn't be consoled and wept bitterly. Others in the group looked at the mother with sympathy or annoyance, but there was nothing they could do to help, and they all walked on disconsolately through the fading landscape as the child's thin cries went on and on and on. The Chevalier Tialis had spoken to Salmakia before skimming ahead, and Will and Lyra watched the dragonfly with eyes greedy for its brightness and vigour as it got smaller and smaller. The lady flew down and perched her insect on Will's hand.
"The Chevalier has gone to see what's ahead," she said. "We think the landscape is fading because these people are forgetting it. The farther they go away from their homes, the darker it will get."
"But why do you think they're moving? If I was a ghost, I'd want to stay in the places I knew, not wander along and get lost."
"They feel unhappy there,"
Will said, guessing.
"It's where they've just died. They're afraid of it."
"No, they're pulled onward by something. Some instinct is drawing them down the road."
And indeed the ghosts were moving more purposefully now that they were out of sight of their own village. The sky was as dark as if a mighty storm were threatening, but there was none of the electric tension that comes ahead of a storm. The ghosts walked on steadily, and the road ran straight ahead across a landscape that was almost featureless. From time to time, one of them would glance at Will or Lyra, or at the brilliant dragonfly and its rider, as if they were curious. Finally, the oldest man said,
You, boy and girl, you ain't dead. You ain't ghosts. What you coming along here for?"
"We came through by accident,"
Lyra told him before Will could speak.
"I don't know how it happened. We were trying to escape from those men, and we just seemed to find ourselves here."
"How will you know when you've got to the place where you've got to go?"
"I expect we'll be told. They'll separate out the sinners and the righteous, I dare say. It's no good praying now. It's too late for that. You should have done that when you were alive. No use now."
It was quite clear which group he expected to be in, and quite clear, too, that he thought it wouldn't be a big one. The other ghosts heard him uneasily, but he was all the guidance they had, so they followed without arguing. And on they walked, trudging in silence under a sky that had finally darkened to a dull iron grey, and remained there without getting any darker. The living ones found themselves looking to their left and right, above and below, for anything that was bright or lively or joyful, and they were always disappointed until a little spark appeared ahead and raced towards them through the air. It was the Chevalier, and Salmakia urged her dragonfly ahead to meet him, with a cry of pleasure. They conferred and sped back to the children.
"There's a town ahead,"
said Tialis.
"It looks like a refugee camp, but it's obviously been there for centuries or more. And I think there's a sea or a lake beyond it, but that's covered in mist. I could hear the cries of birds. And there are hundreds of people arriving every minute from every direction. People like these ghosts.
The ghosts themselves listened as he spoke, though without much curiosity. They seemed to have settled into a dull trance, and Lyra wanted to shake them, to urge them to struggle and wake up and look around for a way out.
How are we going to help these people, Will?
He couldn't even guess. As they moved on, they could see a movement on the horizon to the left and right, and ahead of them a dirty-coloured smoke was rising slowly to add its darkness to the dismal air. The movement was people or ghosts. In lines or pairs or groups or alone, but all empty-handed, hundreds and thousands of men and women and children were drifting over the plain towards the source of the smoke. The ground was sloping downwards now and becoming more and more like a rubbish dump. The air was heavy and full of smoke, and of other smells besides. Acrid chemicals, decaying vegetable matter, sewage. And the further down they went, the worse it got. There was not a patch of clean soil in sight, and the only plants growing anywhere were rank weeds and coarse greyish grass. Ahead of them, above the water, was the mist. It rose like a cliff to merge with the gloomy sky, and from somewhere inside it came those bird cries that Tialis had referred to. Between the waste heaps and the mist, there lay the first town of the dead. Chapter 19. Lyra and Her Death.
I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath. My wrath did end. William Blake.
Here and there, fires had been lit among the ruins. The town was a jumble, with no streets, no squares, and no open spaces except where a building had fallen. A few churches or public buildings still stood above the rest, though their roofs were holed or their walls cracked, and in one case a whole portico had crumbled onto its columns. Between the shells of the stone buildings, a mazy clutter of shacks and shanties had been put together out of lengths of roofing timber, beaten-out petrol cans or biscuit tins, torn plastic sheeting, scraps of plywood or hardboard. The ghosts who had come with them were hurrying towards the town, and from every direction came more of them, so many that they looked like the grains of sand that trickled towards the hole of an hourglass. The ghosts walked straight into the squalid confusion of the town, as if they knew exactly where they were going, and Lyra and Will were about to follow them. But then they were stopped. A figure stepped out of a patched-up doorway and said,
"Wait, wait."
A dim light was glowing behind him, and it wasn't easy to make out his features. But they knew he wasn't a ghost. He was like them, alive. He was a thin man who could have been any age, dressed in a drab and tattered business suit, and he was holding a pencil and a sheaf of papers held together with a clip. The building he'd stepped out of had the look of a customs post on a rarely visited frontier.
"What is this place?"
said Will.
"And why can't we go in?"
"You're not dead. You have to wait in the holding area. Go farther along the road to the left and give these papers to the official at the gate."
"But excuse me, sir, I hope you don't mind me asking, but how can we have come this far if we ain't dead? Because this is the world of the dead, isn't it?"
"It's a suburb of the world of the dead. Sometimes the living come here by mistake, but they have to wait in the holding area before they can go on."
"Wait for how long?"
"Until they die."
Will felt his head swim. He could see Lyra was about to argue, and before she could speak, he said,
"Can you just explain what happens then? I mean, these ghosts who come here, do they stay in this town forever?"
"No, no. This is just a port of transit. They go on beyond here by boat."
"Where to?"
"That's not something I can tell you,"
said the man, and a bitter smile pulled his mouth down at the corners.
"You must move along, please. You must go to the holding area."
Will took the papers the man was holding out, and then held Lyra's arm and urged her away. The dragonflies were flying sluggishly now, and Tialis explained that they needed to rest. So they perched on Will's rucksack, and Lyra let the spies sit on her shoulders. Pantalaimon, leopard-shaped, looked up at them jealously, but he said nothing. They moved along the track, skirting the wretched shanties and the pools of sewage, and watching the never-ending stream of ghosts arriving and passing without hindrance into the town itself.
"We've got to get over the water, like the rest of them, and maybe the people in this holding place will tell us how. They don't seem to be angry anyway, or dangerous. It's strange. And these papers.
They were simply scraps of paper torn from a notebook, with random words scribbled in pencil and crossed out. It was as if these people were playing a game and waiting to see when the travellers would challenge them or give in and laugh. And yet it all looked so real. It was getting darker and colder, and time was hard to keep track of. Lyra thought they walked for half an hour, or maybe it was twice as long. The look of the place didn't change. Finally, they reached a little wooden shack like the one they'd stopped at earlier, where a dim bulb glowed on a bare wire over the door. As they approached, a man dressed much like the other one came out, holding a piece of bread and butter in one hand, and without a word, looked at their papers and nodded. He handed them back and was about to go inside when Will said,
"Excuse me, where do we go now?"
"Go and find somewhere to stay. Just ask. Everybody's waiting, same as you."
He turned away and shut his door against the cold, and the travellers turned down into the heart of the shanty town, where the living people had to stay. It was very much like the main town, shabby little huts, repaired a dozen times, patched with scraps of plastic or corrugated iron, leaning crazily against each other over muddy alleyways. At some places, an unbarrack cable looped down from a bracket and provided enough feeble current to power a naked light bulb or two strung out over the nearby huts. Most of what light there was, however, came from the fires. Their smoky glow flickered redly over the scraps and tatters of building material, as if they were the last remaining flames of a great conflagration, staying alive out of pure malice. But as Will and Lyra and the Gallivespians came closer and saw more detail, they picked out many more figures sitting in the darkness by themselves, or leaning against the walls, or gathered in small groups, talking quietly.
"Why aren't those people inside? It's cold."
"They're not people,"
said the Lady Salmakia.
"They're not even ghosts. They're something else, but I don't know what."
The travellers came to the first group of shacks, which were lit by one of those big, weak unbarrack bulbs on a cable swinging slightly in the cold wind, and Will put his hand on the knife at his belt. There was a group of those people-shaped things outside, crouching on their heels and rolling dice, and when the children came near, they stood up, five of them, all men, their faces in shadow and their clothes shabby, all silent.
"What is the name of this town?"
said Will. There was no reply. Some of them took a step backwards, and all five moved a little closer together, as if they were afraid. Lyra felt her skin crawling, and all the tiny hairs on her arms standing on end, though she couldn't have said why. Inside her shirt, Pantalaimon was shivering and whispering,
"No, no, Lyra, no, go away. Let's go back, please."
The people made no move, and finally Will shrugged and said,
"Well, good evening to you anyway,"
and moved on. They met a similar response from all the other figures they spoke to, and all the time their apprehension grew.
"Will, are they spectres? Are we grown up enough to see spectres now?"
"I don't think so. If we were, they'd attack us, but they seem to be afraid themselves. I don't know what they are."
A door opened, and light spilled out on the muddy ground. A man, a real man, a human being, stood in the doorway, watching them approach. The little cluster of figures around the door moved back a step or two as if out of respect, and they saw the man's face. Stolid, harmless, and mild.
"Who are you?"
he said.
"Travellers,"
said Will.
"We don't know where we are. What is this town?"
"This is the holding area. Have you travelled far?"
"A long way, yes, and we're tired. Could we buy some food and pay for shelter?"
The man was looking past them, into the dark, and then he came out and looked around further as if there were someone missing. Then he turned to the strange figures standing by and said,
"Did you see any death?"
They shook their heads, and the children heard a murmur of,
No.
The man turned back. Behind him, in the doorway, there were faces looking out. A woman, two young children, another man. They were all nervous and apprehensive.
"Death? We're not bringing any death."
But that fact seemed to be the very thing they were worried about, because when Will spoke, there was a soft gasp from the living people, and even the figures outside shrank away a little.
"Excuse me,"
said Lyra, stepping forward in her best polite way, as if the housekeeper of Jordan College were glaring at her.
I couldn't help noticing, but these gentlemen here, are they dead? I'm sorry for asking if it's rude, but where we come from, it's very unusual, and we never saw anyone like them before. If I'm being impolite, I do beg your pardon. But you see, in my world, we have demons. Everyone has a demon. And we'd be shocked if we saw someone without one, just like you're shocked to see us. And now we've been travelling, Will and me, this is Will, and I'm Lyra. I've learned there are some people who don't seem to have demons, like Will doesn't. And I was scared till I found out they were just ordinary like me, really. So maybe that's why someone from your world might be just a bit sort of nervous when they see us, if you think we're different.
Lyra and Will?
Yes, sir.
Are those your demons?
He said, pointing to the spies on her shoulder.
No,
said Lyra, and she was tempted to say, they're our servants, but she felt Will would have thought that a bad idea. So she said,
they're our friends, the Chevalier Tialis and the Lady Salmakia. Very distinguished and wise people who are travelling with us. Oh, and this is my demon,
she said, taking Mouse Pantalaimon out of her pocket.
You see, we're harmless. We promise we won't hurt you. And we do need food and shelter. We'll move on tomorrow, honest.
Everyone waited. The man's nervousness was soothed a little by her humble tone, and the spies had the good sense to look modest and harmless.
Well, though it's strange, I suppose these are strange times. Come in, then. Be welcome.
The figures outside nodded. One or two of them gave little bows, and they stood aside respectfully as Will and Lyra walked into the warmth and light. The man closed the door behind them and hooked a wire over a nail to keep it shut. It was a single room, lit by a naphtha lamp on the table, and clean but shabby. The plywood walls were decorated with pictures cut from film star magazines, and with a pattern made with fingerprints of soot. There was an iron stove against one wall with a clothes horse in front of it, where some dingy shirts were steaming. And on a dressing table there was a shrine of plastic flowers, seashells, coloured scent bottles, and other gaudy bits and pieces, all surrounding the picture of a jaunty skeleton with a top hat and dark glasses. The shanty was crowded. As well as the man and the woman and the two young children, there was a baby in a crib, an older man, and in one corner, in a heap of blankets, a very old woman, who was lying and watching everything with glittering eyes, her face as wrinkled as the blankets. As Lyra looked at her, she had a shock. The blankets stirred, and a very thin arm emerged, in a black sleeve, and then another face, a man's, so ancient it was almost a skeleton. In fact, he looked more like the skeleton in the picture than like a living human being. And then Will, too, noticed, and all the travellers together realised that he was one of those shadowy, polite figures like the ones outside. And all of them felt as nonplussed as the man had been when he'd first seen them. In fact, all the people in the crowded little shack, all except the baby who was asleep, were at a loss for words. It was Lyra who found her voice first.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. Good evening. We're very pleased to be here. And like I said, we're sorry to have arrived without any death, if that's the normal way of things. But we won't disturb you any more than we have to. You see, we're looking for the land of the dead, and that's how we happen to come here. But we don't know where it is, or whether this is part of it, or how to get there or what. So if you can tell us anything about it, we'll be very grateful.
The people in the shack were still staring, but Lyra's words eased the atmosphere a little, and the woman invited them to sit at the table, drawing out a bench. Will and Lyra lifted the sleeping dragonflies up to a shelf in a dark corner, where Tialis said they would rest till daylight, and then the Gallivespians joined them on the table. The woman had been preparing a dish of stew, and she peeled a couple of potatoes and cut them into it to make it go further, urging her husband to offer the travellers some other refreshment while it cooked. He brought out a bottle of clear and pungent spirit that smelled to Lyra like the Egyptian's Geneva, and the two spies accepted a glass into which they dipped little vessels of their own. Lyra would have expected the family to stare most at the Gallivespians, but their curiosity was directed just as much, she thought, at her and Will. She didn't wait long to ask why.
You're the first people we ever saw without a death,
said the man, whose name, they'd learned, was Peter.
Since we come here, that is. We're like you. We come here before we was dead, by some chance or accident. We got to wait till our death tells us it's time.
Your death tells you?
Yes. What we found out when we come here, though long ago for most of us, we found we all brought our deaths with us. This is where we found out. We had them all the time, and we never knew. See, everyone has a death. It goes everywhere with them, all their life long, right close by. Our deaths, they're outside, taking the air. They'll come in by and by. Granny's death, he's there with her. He's close to her. Very close.
Doesn't it scare you, having your death close by all the time?
Why ever would it? If he's there, you can keep an eye on him. I'd be a lot more nervous not knowing where he was.
And everyone has their own death.
Why, yes. The moment you're born, your death comes into the world with you. And it's your death that takes you out.
Ah, that's what we need to know. Because we're trying to find the land of the dead, and we don't know how to get there. Where do we go then, when we die?
Your death taps you on the shoulder, or takes your hand and says, "Come along with me, it's time." It might happen when you're sick with a fever, or when you choke on a piece of dry bread, or when you fall off a high building. In the middle of your pain and travail, your death comes to you kindly and says, "Easy now. Easy, child, you come along with me." And you go with him in a boat out across the lake into the mist. What happens there, no one knows. No one's ever come back.
The woman told a child to call the deaths in, and he scampered to the door and spoke to them. Will and Lyra watched in wonder, and the Gallivespians drew closer together as the deaths, one for each of the family, came in through the door. Pale, unremarkable figures in shabby clothes, just drab and quiet and dull.
"These are your deaths,"
said Tialis.
"Indeed, sir."
"Do you know when they'll tell you it's time to go?"
"No, but you know they're close by, and that's a comfort."
Tialis said nothing, but it was clear that he felt it would be anything but a comfort. The deaths stood politely along the wall, and it was strange to see how little space they took up, and to find how little notice they attracted. Lyra and Will soon found themselves ignoring them altogether, though Will thought, "Those men I killed, their deaths were close beside them all the time. They didn't know, and I didn't know." The woman, Martha, dished the stew onto chipped enamel plates and put some in a bowl for the deaths to pass among themselves. They didn't eat, but the good smell kept them content. Presently all the family and their guests were eating hungrily, and Peter asked the children where they'd come from and what their world was like.
"I'll tell you all about it," said Lyra.
As she said that, as she took charge, part of her felt a little stream of pleasure rising upwards in her breast like the bubbles in champagne. And she knew Will was watching, and she was happy that he could see her doing what she was best at, doing it for him and for all of them. She started by telling about her parents. They were a duke and duchess, very important and wealthy, who had been cheated out of their estate by a political enemy and thrown into prison. But they managed to escape by climbing down a rope with the baby Lyra in her father's arms, and they regained the family fortune, only to be attacked and murdered by outlaws. Lyra would have been killed as well, and roasted and eaten, had not Will rescued her just in time and taken her back to the wolves, in the forest where he was being brought up as one of them. He had fallen overboard as a baby from the side of his father's ship and been washed up on a desolate shore, where a female wolf had suckled him and kept him alive. The people ate up this nonsense with placid credulity, and even the deaths crowded close to listen, perching on the bench or lying on the floor close by, gazing at her with their mild and courteous faces as she spun out the tale of her life with Will in the forest. He and Lyra stayed with the wolves for a while, and then moved to Oxford to work in the kitchens of Jordan College. There they met Roger, and when Jordan was attacked by the brick burners who lived in the clay beds, they had to escape in a hurry. So she and Will and Roger captured an Egyptian narrow boat and sailed it all the way down the Thames, nearly getting caught in Abingdon Lock. And then they'd been sunk by the whopping pirates and had to swim for safety to a three-masted clipper just setting off for Hang Chow in Cathay to trade for tea. and on the clipper they'd met the Gallivespians, who were strangers from the moon, blown down to the earth by a fierce gale out of the Milky Way. They'd taken refuge in the crow's nest, and she and Will and Roger used to take turns going up there to see them. Only one day Roger lost his footing and plunged down into Davy Jones's locker. They tried to persuade the captain to turn the ship around and look for him, but he was a hard, fierce man, only interested in the profit he'd make by getting to Cathay quickly, and he clapped them in irons. But the Gallivespians brought them a file, and so on. From time to time she'd turn to Will or the spies for confirmation, and Salmakia would add a detail or two, or Will would nod, and the story wound itself up to the point where the children and their friends from the moon had to find their way to the land of the dead in order to learn, from her parents, the secret of where the family fortune had been buried.
"And if we knew our deaths in our land, like you do here, it would be easier, probably. But I think we're really lucky to find our way here, so's we could get your advice. And thank you very much for being so kind and listening, and for giving us this meal. It was really nice. But what we need now, you see, or in the morning, maybe, is we need to find a way out across the water, where the dead people go, and see if we can get there too. Is there any boats we could sort of hire?"
They looked doubtful. The children, flushed with tiredness, looked with sleepy eyes from one grown-up to the other, but no one could suggest where they could find a boat. Then came a voice that hadn't spoken before. From the depths of the bedclothes in the corner came a dry, cracked, nasal tone. Not a woman's voice, not a living voice. It was the voice of the grandmother's death.
"The only way you'll cross the lake and go to the land of the dead," he said,
and he was leaning up on his elbow, pointing with a skinny finger at Lyra,
"is with your own deaths. You must call up your own deaths. I have heard of people like you who keep their deaths at bay. You don't like them, and out of courtesy they stay out of sight. But they're not far off. Whenever you turn your head, your deaths dodge behind you. Wherever you look, they hide. They can hide in a teacup, or in a dewdrop, or in a breath of wind. Not like me and old Magda here,"
he said, and he pinched her withered cheek, and she pushed his hand away.
"We live together in kindness and friendship. That's the answer. That's it. That's what you've got to do. Say welcome. Make friends. Be kind. Invite your deaths to come close to you and see what you can get them to agree to."
His words fell into Lyra's mind like heavy stones, and Will, too, felt the deadly weight of them.
"How should we do that?"
"You've only got to wish for it, and the thing is done."
"Wait,"
said Tialis. Every eye turned to him, and those deaths lying on the floor sat up to turn their blank, mild faces to his tiny, passionate one. He was standing close by Salmakia, his hand on her shoulder. Lyra could see what he was thinking. He was going to say that this had gone too far. They must turn back. They were taking this foolishness to irresponsible lengths. So she stepped in.
"Excuse me,"
she said to the man, Peter.
"But me and our friend the Chevalier, we've got to go outside for a minute, because he needs to talk to his friends in the moon through my special instrument. We won't be long."
And she picked him up carefully, avoiding his spurs, and took him outside into the dark, where a loose piece of corrugated iron roofing was banging in the cold wind with a melancholy sound.
"You must stop,"
he said, as she set him on an upturned oil drum, in the feeble light of one of those anbaric bulbs that swung on its cable overhead.
"This is far enough. No more."
"But we made an agreement."
"No, no, not to these lengths."
"All right, leave us. You fly on back. Will can cut a window into your world or any world you like, and you can fly through and be safe. That's all right. We don't mind."
"Do you realize what you're doing?"
"Yes."
"You don't. You're a thoughtless, irresponsible, lying child. Fantasy comes so easily to you that your whole nature is riddled with dishonesty. And you don't even admit the truth when it stares you in the face. Well, if you can't see it, I'll tell you plainly. You cannot. You must not risk your death. You must come back with us now. I'll call Lord Asriel, and we can be safe in the fortress in hours.
Lyra felt a great sob of rage building up in her chest, and stamped her foot, unable to keep still.
You don't know. You just don't know what I got in my head or my heart, do you? I don't know if you people ever have children. Maybe you lay eggs or something. I wouldn't be surprised. Because you're not kind, you're not generous, you're not considerate. You're not cruel, even. That would be better, if you were cruel. Because it'd mean you took us serious. You didn't just go along with us when it suited you. Oh, I can't trust you at all now. You said you'd help, and we'd do it together. And now you want to stop us. You're the dishonest one, Tialis.
I wouldn't let a child of my own speak to me in the insolent, high-handed way you're speaking, Lyra. Why, I haven't punished you before.
Then go ahead. Punish me since you can. Take your bloody spurs and dig 'em in hard. Go on. Here's my hand. Do it. You've got no idea what's in my heart, you proud, selfish creature. You've got no notion how I feel sad and wicked and sorry about my friend Roger. You kill people just like that.
She snapped her finger.
They don't matter to you. But it's a torment and a sorrow to me that I never said goodbye to him. And I want to say sorry and make it as good as I can. You'd never understand that, for all your pride, for all your grown-up cleverness. And if I have to die to do what's proper, then I will, and be happy while I do. I've seen worse than that. So if you want to kill me, you hard man, you strong man, you poison bearer, you chevalier, you do it. Go on, kill me. Then me and Roger can play in the land of the dead forever and laugh at you, you pitiful thing.
What Tialis might have done then wasn't hard to see, for he was ablaze from head to foot with a passionate anger, shaking with it. But he didn't have time to move before a voice spoke behind Lyra, and they both felt a chill fall over them. Lyra turned around, knowing what she'd see and dreading it despite her bravado. The Death stood very close, smiling kindly, his face exactly like those of all the others she'd seen. But this was hers, her very own Death. And Pantalaimon at her breast howled and shivered, and his ermine shape flowed up around her neck and tried to push her away from the Death. But by doing that, he only pushed himself closer, and realizing it, he shrank back towards her again, to her warm throat and the strong pulse of her heart. Lyra clutched him to her and faced the Death directly. She couldn't remember what he'd said, and out of the corner of her eye, she could see Tialis quickly preparing the lodestone resonator, busy.
You're my Death, ain't you?
Yes, my dear.
You ain't gonna take me yet, are you?
You wanted me. I am always here.
Yes, but I did, yes. But I want to go to the land of the dead, that's true. But not to die. I don't want to die. I love being alive. And I love my demon, and demons don't go down there, do they? I've seen them vanish and just go out like candles when people die. Do they have demons in the land of the dead?
No. Your demon vanishes into the air. And you vanish under the ground.
Then I want to take my demon with me when I go to the land of the dead. And I want to come back again. Has it ever been known for people to do that?
Not for many, many ages. Eventually, child, you will come to the land of the dead with no effort, no risk, a safe, calm journey, in the company of your own Death, your special, devoted friend, who's been beside you every moment of your life, who knows you better than yourself.
But Pantalaimon is my special and devoted friend. I don't know you, Death. I know Pan, and I love Pan. And if he ever... if we ever...
The Death was nodding. He seemed interested and kindly, but she couldn't for a moment forget what he was, her very own Death, and so close.
I know it'll be an effort to go on now, and dangerous. But I want to, Death. I do truly. And so does Will. We both had people taken away too soon. And we need to make amends. At least I do.
Everyone wishes they could speak again to those who've gone to the land of the dead. Why should there be an exception for you?
Because...
she began, lying.
Because there's something I've got to do there. Not just seeing my friend Roger. Something else. It was a task put on me by an angel, and no one else can do it, only me. It's too important to wait till I die in the natural way. It's got to be done now. See, the angel commanded me. That's why we came here, me and Will. We got to.
Behind her, Tialis put away his instrument and sat watching the child plead with her own death to be taken where no one should go. The death scratched his head and held up his hands, but nothing could stop Lyra's words, nothing could deflect her desire, not even fear. She'd seen worse than death, she claimed, and she had, too. So eventually her death said,
"If nothing can put you off, then all I can say is, come with me and I will take you there, into the land of the dead. I'll be your guide. I can show you the way in, but as for getting out again, you'll have to manage by yourself."
"And my friends? My friend Will and the others?"
"Lyra,"
said Tialis,
"against every instinct we'll go with you. I was angry with you a minute ago, but you make it hard."
Lyra knew that this was a time to conciliate, and she was happy to do that, having got her way.
"Yes, I am sorry, Tialis, but if you hadn't got angry, we'd never have found this gentleman to guide us. So I'm glad you were here, you and the lady. I'm really grateful to you for being with us."
So Lyra persuaded her own death to guide her and the others into the land where Roger had gone, and Will's father, and Tony Makarios, and so many others. And her death told her to go down to the jetty when the first light came to the sky, and prepare to leave. But Pantalaimon was trembling and shivering, and nothing Lyra could do could soothe him into stillness, or quiet the soft little moan he couldn't help uttering. So her sleep was broken and shallow, on the floor of the shack with all the other sleepers, and her death sat watchfully beside her. Chapter 20. Climbing.
I gained it so, by climbing slow, by catching at the twigs that grow between the bliss and me. Emily Dickinson.
The Mulefa made many kinds of rope and cord, and Mary Malone spent a morning inspecting and testing the ones Atal's family had in their stores before choosing what she wanted. The principle of twisting and winding hadn't caught on in their world, so all the cords and ropes were braided. But they were strong and flexible, and Mary soon found exactly the sort she wanted.
"What are you doing?"
said Atal. The Mulefa had no term for climb, so Mary had to do a lot of gesturing and roundabout explaining. Atal was horrified.
"To go into the high part of the trees?"
"I must see what is happening,"
Mary explained.
"Now, you can help me prepare the rope."
Once in California, Mary had met a mathematician who spent every weekend climbing among the trees. Mary had done a little rock climbing, and she'd listened avidly as he had talked about the techniques and equipment. She decided to try it herself as soon as she had the chance. Of course, she'd never expected to be climbing trees in another universe, and climbing solo didn't greatly appeal either, but there was no choice about that. What she could do was make it as safe as possible beforehand. She took a coil long enough to reach over one of the branches of a high tree and back down to the ground, and strong enough to bear several times her weight. Then she cut a large number of short pieces of a smaller but very tough cord and made slings with them, short loops tied with a fisherman's knot, which could make hand and footholds when she tied them to the main line. Then there was the problem of getting the rope over the branch in the first place. An hour or two's experimenting with some fine, tough cord and a length of springy branch produced a bow. The Swiss Army knife cut some arrows with stiff leaves in place of feathers to stabilize them in flight. And finally, after a day's work, Mary was ready to begin. But the sun was setting and her hands were tired, and she ate and slept, preoccupied, while the Mulefa discussed her endlessly in their quiet, musical whispers. First thing in the morning, she set off to shoot an arrow over a branch. Some of the Mulefa gathered to watch, anxious for her safety. Climbing was so alien to creatures with wheels that the very thought of it horrified them. Privately, Mary knew how they felt. She swallowed her nervousness and tied an end of the thinnest, lightest line to one of her arrows and sent it flying upwards from the bow. She lost the first arrow. It stuck in the bark part way up and wouldn't come out. She lost the second because, although it did clear the branch, it didn't fall far enough to reach the ground on the other side, and pulling it back she caught it and snapped it. The long line fell back attached to the broken shaft, and she tried again with the third and last, and this time it worked. Pulling carefully and steadily so as not to snag the line and break it, she hauled the prepared rope up and over until both ends were on the ground. Then she tied them both securely to a massive buttress of one of the roots, as thick around as her own hips, so it should be fairly solid, she thought. It had better be. What she couldn't tell from the ground, of course, was what kind of branch the whole thing, including her, would be depending on. Unlike climbing on rock, where you could fasten the rope to pitons on the cliff face every few yards so you never had far to fall, this business involved one very long free length of rope, and one very long fall if anything went wrong. To make herself a little more secure, she braided together three small ropes into a harness, and passed it around both hanging ends of the main rope with a loose knot that she could tighten the moment she began to slip. Mary put her foot in the first sling and began to climb. She reached the canopy in less time than she'd anticipated. The climbing was straightforward, the rope was kindly on her hands, and although she hadn't wanted to think about the problem of getting on top of the first branch, she found that the deep fissures and the bark helped her to get a solid purchase and feel secure. In fact, only 15 minutes after she'd left the ground, she was standing on the first branch and planning her route to the next. She had brought two more coils of rope with her, intending to make a web of fixed lines to serve in place of the pitons and anchors and friends, and other hardware she relied on when climbing a rock face. Tying them in place took her some minutes more, and once she'd secured herself, she chose what looked like the most promising branch, coiled her spare rope again, and set off. After 10 minutes' careful climbing, she found herself right in the thickest part of the canopy. She could reach the long leaves and run them through her hands. She found flower after flower, off-white and absurdly small, each growing the little coin-sized thing that would later become one of those great iron-hard seed pods. She reached a comfortable spot where three branches forked, tied the rope securely, adjusted her harness, and rested. Through the gaps in the leaves she could see the blue sea, clear and sparkling as far as the horizon. And in the other direction over her right shoulder, she could see the succession of low rises in the gold-brown prairie, laced across by the black highways. There was a light breeze, which lifted a faint scent out of the flowers and rustled the stiff leaves, and Mary imagined a huge, dim benevolence holding her up, like a pair of giant hands. As she lay on the fork of the great branches, she felt a kind of bliss she had only felt once before, and that was not when she made her vows as a nun. Eventually she was brought back to her normal state of mind by a cramp in her right ankle, which was resting awkwardly in the crook of the fork. She eased it away and turned her attention to the task, still dizzy from the sense of oceanic gladness that surrounded her. She'd explained to the Mulefa how she had to hold the sap lacquer plates a handspan apart in order to see the thruff, and at once they'd seen the problem and made a short tube of bamboo, fixing the amber-coloured plates at each end like a telescope. This spyglass was tucked in her breast pocket, and she took it out now. When she looked through it, she saw those drifting golden sparkles, the thruff, the shadows, Lyra's dust, like a vast cloud of tiny beings floating through the wind. For the most part, they drifted randomly like dust motes in a shaft of sunlight or molecules in a glass of water. For the most part. But the longer she looked, the more she began to see another kind of motion. Underlying the random drifting was a deeper, slower, universal movement out from the land towards the sea. Well, that was curious. Securing herself to one of her fixed ropes, she crawled out along a horizontal branch, looking closely at all the flower heads she could find. And presently she began to see what was happening. She watched and waited till she was perfectly sure, and then began the careful, lengthy, strenuous process of climbing down. Mary found the Mulefa in a fearful state, having suffered 1,000 anxieties for their friend so far off the ground. Atal was especially relieved, and touched her nervously all over with her trunk, uttering gentle whinnies of pleasure to find her safe, and carrying her swiftly down to the settlement along with a dozen or so others. As soon as they came over the brow of the hill, the call went out among those in the village, and by the time they reached the speaking ground, the throng was so thick that Mary guessed there were many visitors from elsewhere come to hear what she said. She wished she had better news for them. The old Zalif Satamax mounted the platform and welcomed her warmly, and she responded with all the Mulefa courtesy she could remember. As soon as the greetings were over, she began to speak. Haltingly and with many roundabout phrasings, she said,
"My good friends, I have been into the high canopy of your trees, and looked closely at the growing leaves and the young flowers and the seed pods. I could see that there is a current of Thrath high in the treetops, and it moves against the wind. The air is moving inland off the sea, but the Thrath is moving slowly against it. Can you see that from the ground? Because I could not.
No, said Setimax. That is the first we ever heard about that.
Well, the trees are filtering the Thrath as it moves through them, and some of it is attracted to the flowers. I could see it happening. The flowers are turned upwards, and if the Thrath were falling straight down, it would enter their petals and fertilize them like pollen from the stars. But the Thrath isn't falling down. It's moving out towards the sea. When a flower happens to be facing the land, the Thrath can enter it. That's why there are still some seed pods growing. But most of them face upwards, and the Thrath just drifts past without entering. The flowers must have evolved like that, because in the past, all the Thrath fell straight down. Something has happened to the Thrath, not to the trees, and you can only see that current from high up, which is why you never knew about it. So if you want to save the trees and Mulefa life, we must find out why the Thrath is doing that. I can't think of a way yet, but I will try.
She saw many of them craning to look upwards at this drift of dust, but from the ground you couldn't see it. She looked through the spyglass herself, but the dense blue of the sky was all she could see. They spoke for a long time, trying to recall any mention of the Thrath wind among their legends and histories, but there was none. All they had ever known was that Thrath came from the stars, as it had always done. Finally they asked if Mary had any more ideas, and she said,
I need to make more observations. I need to find out whether the wind goes always in that direction, or whether it alters like the air currents during the day and the night. So I need to spend more time in the treetops, and sleep up there, and observe at night. I will need your help to build a platform of some kind, so I can sleep safely. But we do need more observations.
The Mulefa, practical and anxious to find out, offered at once to build her whatever she needed. They knew the techniques of using pulleys and tackle, and presently one suggested a way of lifting Mary easily into the canopy so as to save her the dangerous labor of climbing. Glad to have something to do, they set about gathering materials at once, braiding and tying and lashing spars and ropes and lines under her guidance, and assembling everything she needed for a treetop observation platform. After speaking to the old couple by the olive grove, Father Gomez lost the track. He spent several days searching and inquiring in every direction, but the woman seemed to have vanished completely. He would never have given up, although it was discouraging. The crucifix around his neck and the rifle at his back were twin tokens of his absolute determination to complete the task. But it would have taken him much longer if it hadn't been for a difference in the weather. In the world he was in, it was hot and dry, and he was increasingly thirsty. And seeing a wet patch of rock at the top of a scree, he climbed up to see if there was a spring there. There wasn't, but in the world of the wheel pod trees there had just been a shower of rain. And so it was that he discovered the window, and found where Mary had gone. Chapter 21 The Harpies.
I hate things all fiction. There should always be some foundation of fact. Byron.
Lyra and Will each awoke with a heavy dread. It was like being a condemned prisoner on the morning fixed for the execution. Dialis and Salmakia were attending to their dragonflies, bringing them moths lassoed near the Anbaric lamp over the oil drum outside, flies cut from spiderwebs, and water in a tin plate. When she saw the expression on Lyra's face, and the way that Pantalaimon, mouse-formed, was pressing himself close to her breast, the Lady Salmakia left what she was doing to come and speak with her. Will, meanwhile, left the hut to walk about outside.
"You can still decide differently,"
said Salmakia.
"No, we can't. We decided already,"
said Lyra, stubborn and fearful at once.
"And if we don't come back?"
"You don't have to come."
"We're not going to abandon you."
"Then what if you don't come back?"
We shall have died doing something important.
Lyra was silent. She hadn't really looked at the lady before, but she could see her very clearly now in the smoky light of the naphtha lamp, standing on the table just an arm's length away. Her face was calm and kindly, not beautiful, not pretty, but the very sort of face you would be glad to see if you were ill or unhappy or frightened. Her voice was low and expressive, with a current of laughter and happiness under the clear surface. In all the life she could remember, Lyra had never been read to in bed. No one had told her stories or sung nursery rhymes with her before kissing her and putting out the light. But she suddenly thought now that if ever there was a voice that would lap you in safety and warm you with love, it would be a voice like the Lady Salmakia's. And she felt a wish in her heart to have a child of her own, to lull and soothe and sing to, one day, in a voice like that.
Well,
Lyra said, and found her throat choked, so she swallowed and shrugged.
We'll see,
said the lady, and turned back. Once they had eaten their thin, dry bread and drunk their bitter tea, which was all the people had to offer them, they thanked their hosts, took their rucksacks, and set off through the shanty town for the lake shore. Lyra looked around for her death, and sure enough, there he was, walking politely a little way ahead. But he didn't want to come closer, though he kept looking back to see if they were following. The day was overhung with a gloomy mist. It was more like dusk than daylight, and wraiths and streamers of the fog rose dismally from puddles in the road, or clung like forlorn lovers to the Anbaric cables overhead. They saw no people and few deaths, but the dragonflies skimmed through the damp air, as if they were sewing it all together with invisible threads, and it was a delight to the eyes to watch their bright colours flashing back and forth. Before long they had reached the edge of the settlement, and made their way beside a sluggish stream through bare-twigged, scrubby bushes. Occasionally they would hear a harsh croak or a splash as some amphibian was disturbed, but the only creature they saw was a toad as big as Will's foot, which could only flop in a pain-filled sideways heave as if it were horribly injured. It lay across the path, trying to move out of the way and looking at them as if it knew they meant to hurt it.
It would be merciful to kill it, said Tialis.
How do you know?
Said Lyra.
It might still like being alive, in spite of everything.
If we killed it, we'd be taking it with us,
said Will.
It wants to stay here. I've killed enough living things. Even a filthy, stagnant pool might be better than being dead.
But if it's in pain...
If it could tell us, we'd know. But since it can't, I'm not going to kill it. That would be considering our feelings, rather than the toad's.
They moved on. Before long, the changing sound their footsteps made told them that there was an openness nearby, although the mist was even thicker. Pantalaimon was a lemur, with the biggest eyes he could manage, clinging to Lyra's shoulder, pressing himself into her fog-pearled hair, peering all around and seeing no more than she did. And still he was trembling and trembling. Suddenly they all heard a little wave breaking. It was quiet, but it was very close by. The dragonflies returned with their riders to the children, and Pantalaimon crept into Lyra's breast as she and Will moved closer together, treading carefully along the slimy path. And then they were at the shore. The oily, scummy water lay still in front of them, an occasional ripple breaking languidly on the pebbles. The path turned to the left, and a little way along, more like a thickening of the mist than a solid object, a wooden jetty stood crazily out over the water. The piles were decayed and the planks were green with slime, and there was nothing else, nothing beyond it. The path ended where the jetty began, and where the jetty ended, the mist began. Lyra's death, having guided them there, bowed to her and stepped into the fog, vanishing before she could ask him what to do next.
Listen,
said Will. There was a slow, repetitive sound out on the invisible water, a creak of wood and a quiet, regular splash. Will put his hand on the knife at his belt and moved forward carefully onto the rotting planks. Lyra followed close behind. The dragonflies perched on the two weed-covered mooring posts, looking like heraldic guardians, and the children stood at the end of the jetty, pressing their open eyes against the mist, and having to brush their lashes free of the drops that settled on them. The only sound was that slow creak and splash that was getting closer and closer.
Don't let's go,
Pantalaimon whispered.
Got to,
Lyra whispered back. She looked at Will. His face was set hard and grim and eager. He wouldn't turn aside. And the Gallivespians, Dialis on Will's shoulder, Salmakia on Lyra's, were calm and watchful. The dragonfly's wings were pearled with mist, like cobwebs, and from time to time they'd beat them quickly to clear them, because the drops must make them heavy, Lyra thought.